I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Ajit here is a cultural journalist, an academic, and one of Canada's leading public intellectuals. If you follow him on Twitter, his handle is @HereJeet. You are often treated to his thoughts and observations, and sometimes his conversations with others, on fascinating aspects of our culture. He is credited with a Twitter essay, numbered tweets on a subject that engage his followers and others on a topic that refuses to be confined to a mere 140 characters. He may not have invented the Twitter essay, but he's helped make it ubiquitous in our discourse. A new collection of essays has just been published, Sweet Lechery, Reviews, Essays, and Profiles, taken from Mr. Heer's prolific work that's appeared in sundry publications, including the National Post, the Globe and Mail, Canadian Notes and Queries, The Walrus, The Boston Globe, The Comics Journal, and The New Republic, where he recently had a cover story on the magazine and its history on race, which, incidentally, I saw discussed on the Charlie Rose program last week when the magazine's controversial publisher, proprietor, was made an appearance. I'll ask Mr. Heer, who joins me now, about the themes to which he's categorized the essays in this collection, his interests, his writing, and how he views the role of the public intellectual in our discourse. He is a recipient of the Fulbright scholarship and has received degrees from the University of Toronto and York University. The website for more is at jeethere.com. The book is published by the Porcupine's Quill and is a terribly engaging collection that looks at the work of influential writers here in Canada and beyond, as well as nonfiction and comics, as well as right-wing politics. Please welcome to the Plant Online program from Regina, Saskatchewan today, Jeet Heer. Mr. Heer, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be talking to you. Thank you for the very kind introduction.
Well, thanks for joining us. So in the introduction, you write that books are work and essays are play. And for people listening to us, that's not to suggest that there's no work involved. But how do you view the essay, if you will? I mean, you write that it's not as final as, say, a scholarly work might be. So I'm curious to know, do you find that your thinking changes, and at the same time, what's clear to me as the reader is that you're enjoying the process, are you?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I think I sort of look at the essay in the sort of classical meaning of the word, which is not perhaps something where people might be familiar with from school, where they, you know, an essay is an assignment and you kind of have to, you know, dutifully write on a topic. But I think if you go back to the origins of the essay, you know, to Montaigne, the origins of the word are in the French word essay, to attempt, right? An essay is not you're simply attempting to survey a topic rather than offering a final judgment. So when I'm writing, say, about the science fiction writer Robert Heinlein or the economist John Maynard Keynes, I'm not writing a monograph, I'm writing a definitive book. I'm writing a quicker kind of survey than trying to, like, bring them up to date and introduce them into the current conversation. So I do see it as a more playful form, and that's one reason why I'm attracted to it, and I really wanted, I try to convey that playfulness in how I approach topics, yeah.
In being playful, how much of what you write or what compels you to write wants to convince the reader, say, as to your way of thinking?
Well, I think, I like everyone else, I'm always, I happen to think I'm right about things, and so, I do want to convince people, but I don't want to convince people in the sort of hectoring way of, an opinion writer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I have worked as a newspaper columnist before, and I sort of don't, although they're talented newspaper columnists, I don't enjoy the form myself because I find that, you know, you become kind of hectoring, and you become, you know, you're sort of like trying to hammer that nail in. And if I'm trying to persuade people, I'm trying to persuade them through, not with a bludgeon or a weapon, but through wit and through, you know, trying to get them to see things in a different way than they might otherwise. And I do, in general, I find, like, you know, honey wins you more friends than vinegar.
Indeed, yeah. So in the act of writing, do you find that you persuade yourself a lot of time?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, that I often don't know what I think about a subject until I actually start writing about it, right? That I think the, the title is taken from a great phrase by the writer Guy Davenport, the sweet lechery of the inquiring mind. And when I'm saying a topic, I don't necessarily, go in knowing, oh, this is what I think about a topic. It's more like I'm going to be exploring this, and then I sort of come to conclusions along the way. And I find that even more so with the Twitter essay, which, as you mentioned, I didn't create, but I certainly helped popularize, where often in a Twitter essay, I'll start in on a topic, and I don't necessarily have, or I might start with an opinion, but then I get challenged by people. And one of the great things on Twitter is that, once you pick up a few followers, they do respond to you. And so my thinking on a subject might change as I'm writing. And I mean, that certainly happens on Twitter, and I think it even happens, in writing these essays themselves, yeah.
And in all writing, I guess for you, it is a process of evolution, that it is important to evolve at times and thus change one's opinions on matters.
That's right, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. And then not and to maybe even raise questions that you don't necessarily know the answer to. I'll give you one example. I very much admire, as many other people do, the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, and there's a curious incident in his biography where Philip K. Dick was visited by a group of Marxist literary critics who liked his work and who published a magazine celebrating it, and then he started writing letters to the FBI, denouncing these critics and saying that they're a danger to America. And I didn't know going into writing about that, what I actually thought about this. I think that Dick was simply, mentally unstable, or is this a mark against his character? And writing the essay was an attempt to answer questions of that sort. And, through the process of interviewing people who were involved in this incident, reading Dick's own writing and his letters and trying to, trying to figure out what exactly happened there. So it is in a sense, I try to frame questions that I don't know the answer to.
In the book, you describe yourself as a social democrat, but what attracted me to you on Twitter were your tweets on the right, of people of the right, of conservative yeah. politics and right-wing thinking. So it seems to me, because in the book you also have a section where you talk about right-wing thinkers, where you have essays on right-wing thinkers. Does that interest you in the sense that you're wanting to, say, poke holes in the argument of conservatives or say, reveal hypocrisy on their part?
Well, I certainly do that, although I don't think that's, necessarily my main goal. I mean, I think, we're living through a period where the right has been very successful, right? I think going back to, the Reagan era, at the very least, there's been a sort of, really resurgent right-wing culture, and so I'm trying to figure out where does that culture come from, what are these people saying, and then of course offering critiques along the way, although but also in some cases I think it varies in terms of who I'm writing about, right? I think the in the case of someone like Hugh Kenner, who's a very conservative literary critic, there's actually a lot in his work that I sort of admire and can find a value. I think there are other figures that are maybe more dubious and where I do maybe point out more hypocrisies because there are more hypocrisies. Maybe another way to think about this is, I write about Rob Ford in this book, and I think for me the interesting thing about Rob Ford is how this guy, who's clearly terrible on many different levels. His base of support is the north end of Toronto in Etobicoke, which is a very working class area, and it happens to be where I grew up. And then very immigrant, right? And then there's a lot of people of color who support Rob Ford, even though he's, said a lot of very racist things. And I would even go further, has policies that are, I think, harmful to working-class people in general, including working-class immigrants. So with Ford, I think the question then I have to ask myself is, why is this, buffoon and criminal so popular, among people who, one would think wouldn't like him?
Yeah, and I guess in that piece on Ford, you also wonder why, well, this is what I got in reading it. I don't know if you thought this too, is that you wonder why no one else can tap into that community like he can, and one conceivably means why can't the left be as effective in getting their support as he has?
Yeah, I think that was definitely like a sort of question that I think we need to ask about Ford, like, because he's very much tapping into a genuine populist anger of people who feel excluded, and then in other times and circumstances that anger would have moved people to the left, and so there's a question of like why. Hasn't there? Yeah. Why is he able to appeal, win that appeal, and others can't? So yeah. I think in writing about the right, I mean, it's fun, and I certainly talking about some of these figures, you know, there's all sorts of hypocrisies and failings that one can point out, which I'm happy to do so, and I do so. But I do think I part of the issue is like trying to find out what is the appeal of these ideas as well.
Yeah, you seem to immerse yourself in say, the writing of a lot of people who are conservatives, which I would probably find fun if that's in fact what you do all day is you read old magazines and a lot of books. Is that what you do in terms of what your job is, say?
Well, I like a lot of people, I sort of have a variety of different jobs. I mean, I do sort of like academic work, and, mm-hmm. and one of the benefits of that is I do get to read like a lot of old magazines and stuff like that. And yeah, it is something I also just sort of do, you know, for fun. And So I mean, it is, and yeah, I think when I'm writing about somebody, I do try to like read, you know, as much of their work as I can. And to try to have, which might be, I don't know, I mean, like, there might be a problem with that. Like, it could be a very, it's economically inefficient, right? Like, but I do think that it's, I think if I'm going to take someone's work seriously, I do have to try to know as much about it as I can. I think I'll give you a story about this because it mm-hmm. illustrates the sort of economic problems of this, which is it's not in this collection, but I wrote a piece on the Canadian writer Russell Smith with one of his short story collections coming out, and I read the collection, and then I went back and I read his two previous novels, and then I read some of the writers he had cited as influences, Kingsley Amis and Evelyn Waugh. And so I ended up reading about like 12 books altogether. And then I wrote like a 3,000 word review, which is about Russell Smith and the tradition that he's coming out of. And then I got paid, I was going to get paid $25 from the magazine, but the editor liked it so much that he said he'd give me a bonus, which so I got paid $50.
Your manager probably didn't think it was an effective use of time.
No. I don't think. I mean, this is back when I was a graduate student. So I could afford that more than.
So it seems to me when I read you on Twitter or I read these essays in the book that you seem to be enjoying the work. I mean, that comes through in the writing.
Yeah.
So you must right?
Yeah, huh? Oh, yeah. No, I do enjoy, I mean, I enjoy writing, and yeah, I mean, I rarely write about someone whose work doesn't give me some pleasure on some form. I mean, I think occasionally, you know, like I'd be asked to review somebody whose work I don't like, and I try to avoid such assignments, unless it's like a really big writer who needs to be taken down, right? But if it's just someone I don't like, it's not worth it for me to review their work, and that isn't fun, really. So I think that's right. Yeah, I do enjoy it, and I feel it's important for me to be enjoying it. So because I feel then the reader will also enjoy the reading experience, right? Like I have to convey the enthusiasm I have for this.
As someone who views culture as you do, does being Canadian factor in the lens that you use in terms of being critical, say, about culture?
That's a very interesting question, because, I mean, there's a whole section of this book that's about Canadian literature, and, yeah, I mean, I'm an immigrant, but I do feel like there's something very specifically Canadian in my approach, and I think the figure, I was thinking about this with an American writer who was born in Canada, Clive Thompson, whose book I reviewed, and he struck me as taking a very judicious approach of like always trying to be balanced and trying to look at competing claims, and he would come to conclusions, but only after sort of weighing them. And there's, like, not all Canadians are like that, but there's a kind of Canadian tradition of, you can see in someone like Northrop Frye that's very much like that, you know, of a kind of like a balanced approach.
But you seem to be a writer who can easily write for an American audience at the same time. I mean, is that you do bring some Canadian sensibilities, but you're not overly pronounced as a Canadian, say, if you're writing in the New Republic.
Yeah, no, that's right. I do write for American publications, and to be frank, I think increasingly I'm going to, just because, like, they pay more, and the audience is bigger, and, I mean, like, I would love to be able to, you know, like, just make my, to do all of this inside Canada, but I'm not sure if that's, like, really viable. And the other aspect, which is kind of interesting, is, like, you know, like, when I write about, like, racial stuff, I find it easier to write for an American audience than a Canadian one. That I think that in Canada, the discourse is kind of, like, a little bit primitive and unsophisticated, and that the, and Canadians are more uncomfortable talking about this stuff, I find. Mm-hmm. So I do find, like, if I'm writing about anything that has a racial theme, like, it's better to write it for the New Republic than for Canadian publication. I mean, maybe I'm being unfair. I don't know.
Do you think that Canada needs to grow up, say?
I think so, yeah. I think that Canadians are very, I think the sort of Canadian non-confrontational attitude makes it harder for them to, like, to have honest discussions about race and racism. I think that's right, yeah. And we saw this with the Rob Ford thing, because, I mean, it is kind of astonishing, like, how racist Rob Ford was, and even Doug Ford, and how racist the campaign was, and that this was not, like, front and center of, like, a discussion, right? Like, I mean, you had, you know, Doug Ford supporters who, like, you know, told Olivia Chow to go back to China, right? And you had, like, Rob and Doug, like, constantly making, you know, like, really incendiary. And then they became topics of discussion, but they didn't, like, really, like, define them. And they were kind of able to get away with it, like, in a sense, you know?
So what has to change in our media culture and our discourse in Canada? You told Mansbridge recently on the National that the media is too white. So do you think if it were less white, we'd be able to have the sort of conversations that you'd like to have, that we need to have?
Yeah, I think that's a big factor. I do think that in America, I feel more comfortable having these discussions in America because I have, you know, sort of people I can engage in discussions with who aren't just white, but I can assume that the audience isn't just white and that the people I'm going to be engaged in a discussion with. So I do have, you know, as you mentioned on Twitter and stuff like that, I have, I think, you know, like, very productive conversations with someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates, right? Mm-hmm. Or Jamel Bowie or Anna Holmes or, you know, people of that sort. Whereas, like, in Canada, I can't think of very many people like that. You know, because as I said on Mansbridge, I mean, it's not a matter of the media being too white. It's like, you know, the Canadian media is, like, it's whiter than snow. It's whiter than cocaine. You know, it's like, and I think so I think if there were more, I would imagine if there were First Nations voices, we could have a more productive sort of conversation about a lot of this stuff.
So why do you think we're unwilling to allow different voices in our media culture?
Well, it's a complicated thing, and I don't think it's, like, a matter of, like,
just adding people, say.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. One is, like just sociologically, like, I think, you know, like, a lot of online people do come from immigrant backgrounds, and so they come from backgrounds where there's a healthy sense of, you know, economic necessity, right? And an awareness that, you know, like, if you want your kids to do well, you have them go into, like, commerce or science or something of that sort, or become a teacher, rather than become a journalist. So that already adds a kind of, you know, the immigrant background adds a kind of strain. And then what you find is often, you know, media jobs are legacy jobs. The people who are in the media are people whose parents or grandparents had been in the media, right? And also, like, as, but I mean, the media, people interested in media are diversifying at, like, say, the J school level, right, where you would see a lot of people of color, but that's happening at the very time where the media jobs are contracting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have the, you know, so at the very point at which you would be normally seeing more diversity, you know, like, the number of media jobs have contracted, so... So I think that it's a very complicated sort of sociological and economic phenomenon that's kind of going on there. And conversely, though, but I mean, I think there's also a general, like, there's not that awareness that you do have in America that, like, these different voices bring some perspective that you're not otherwise getting. Like, I think in America, you know, like, even... especially conservative outlets try to have some, you know, tokenism at least, mm-hmm. because they realize, you know, you can't just present a white face, whereas I don't think you have that in Canada. Like, I think there's not an awareness that, you know, you have to have a media that in some ways reflects the country.
So where is the role of, say, the public intellectual in our discourse today? I mean, 30, 40 years ago, it wasn't uncommon that you'd see people like Gore Vidal or William F. Buckley on The Tonight Show. You're someone who's a leading voice on Twitter. How would you like to see the role of the public intellectual, say, evolve in our discourse today? I mean, does he or she come back and become a part of the conversation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think, well, first of all, I'm sort of uncomfortable with the idea of the public intellectual, because I think that the, I think of myself as a journalist,
mm-hmm.
And also, in wearing another hat, I'm a scholar, but I mean, those are kind of like different things, which can sometimes sort of come together. I mean, that sort of, you know, Gore Vidal, Norman Mailer stuff, I don't think is going to come back, just because the media landscape has fragmented to such a degree, right? And I think what you're conversely seeing is more public outlets, smaller outlets, like, say, on cable. Someone like Chris Hayes might be a good example, you know, because he's a genuine intellectual. He's written, like, a really solid book, and he has a show on MSNBC. So there are these kind of, like, and there are these sort of podcasts and stuff like that where people are making themselves known. And then, yeah, I think Twitter definitely has a role. I think one of the interesting things with Twitter is that it's created a bridge between academic historians and journalists, right? So you often see someone like Coates on Twitter engaged in discussions with, like, you know, some of the top historians on race, mm-hmm. in America, right? We're living in an age of sort of, like, you know, sort of fragmentation of the media. But within those smaller outlets, you can definitely have niches that emerge.
And so, how do you see your profile, say, in the discourse? I mean, would you like to be seen more, be heard more?
Well, I guess. I mean, up to a point. I mean, I think my main thing is just to write about things I'm kind of interested in. I don't really care, like, you know. And to the extent of having an audience is, like, having a sufficient audience that can, like, you know, pay the bills or whatever, mm-hmm. right? Like, but I don't think you necessarily want, like, I mean, in terms of having an impact, like, the size of an audience isn't necessarily always the most relevant thing. Dwight MacDonald used to edit a magazine called Politics, a sort of anarchist radical magazine during World War II, which was really, like, way ahead of its time. I mean, it had, you know, articles in the 40s on, like, sort of gay rights, and it had, like, early articles during World War II about, you know, the concentration camps when no one was writing about them, and published people like Hannah Arendt. And it had, like, you know, like, you know, between 3,000 to 6,000 subscribers. And then after that, MacDonald closed it down, he went to work for The New Yorker, and he would publish articles there, and some of which got quite a bit of attention. But he would remark that, you know, like, there were, like, he got more mail and more response and more people talk to him about stuff he published in Politics and stuff he published in The New Yorker, right? Mm-hmm. Even though The New Yorker had, like, you know, was selling a million copies and Politics sold, like, 6,000 copies, because everyone who read Politics read it, like, front to back, and they were reading it because they were finding stuff there they couldn't find anywhere else. And so every one of those readers is an important magazine too. Whereas when he was writing something in The New Yorker, you know, like, not everybody who reads The New Yorker reads it all the way through. In fact, most people probably don't. And then when you're reading in The New Yorker, it's like, you know, one of many different magazines that you're reading, and you're not necessarily thinking, like, I'm getting something here that's nowhere else in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a roundabout way of saying, like, but I think that, like, for McDonald, and I think generally it's true that, like, you know, I mean, you want to have an impact on readers, but that doesn't necessarily mean having more readers.
From this collection, and I've probably already told you this, that your writing is what one reviewer said, a real pleasure to read. But I'm sure you have critics, I'm sure you have detractors.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear from them, how much of what they say is constructive for you as a writer?
that's interesting. I don't think I've received any really negative reviews I can think of. I think for, like, an earlier book I did on François Mouly, I mean, there were some people who said the book was a bit too short, but I mean, that's kind of the intent of the book, was to be, like, you know, something you can read in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, I always try to take criticism, like, seriously, like, to try to engage in it, but I mean, I don't necessarily change what I'm doing as a response to that. I think that's kind of maybe someone will come up with a really pointed criticism. Well, I think one thing was someone had mentioned I use the word arguably too much, and I thought, like, I kind of do, so I've been avoiding that word.
Did you have trolls though on Twitter?
Well, I mean, like, everyone on Twitter has trolls. But, I mean, I think I'm pretty good about, like, not responding. Like, I think the mute button on Twitter is a useful kind of function. And yeah, I find the trolls aren't. Yeah, I mean, I'm in some ways it's a form of masculine privilege, because I have, like, female friends who, you know, they have terrible trolls who, like, you know, like, really say nasty personal stuff. And I know women writers who avoid things like Twitter for that reason. And so I think, you know, like, as a man, you're kind of like, you're given a certain sort of safety or privilege in the society where it's like, you know, like, nothing that's said against you of that sort really, you know, weighs that much.
Now, you're someone who has studied Little Orphan Annie a great deal over the years. There was a joke this past Sunday at the Academy Awards that because of the latest film version, thankfully we'll never see another one again.
Yeah, it's possible that the I thought that the recent Annie was a very disappointing. I took my daughter to it, and I think it's pretty okay in terms of appealing to that young girl audience. But it was disappointing because I thought there's stuff especially with the current, like, recession.
Mm-hmm.
And the economic disparity. Like, there's a lot of themes in Annie that could have they could have done more with, but they made it really anodyne and really too sweet, you know.
And the original film version, is that something that you liked?
No, I actually only like... the Annie I really like is a comic strip from the 20s and 30s, and that's part of my interest on the right.
Mm-hmm.
Because the cartoonist was very right-wing. Like, he basically saw Franklin Roosevelt as a communist, and in the strip itself, Annie... You know, she's an orphan girl, and she wants to work, but there are these terrible social workers that have these child labor laws that won't let her work, and she's rescued by Daddy Warbucks, who's an arms dealer. And in the movie, they changed Warbucks to Will Stack, you know, so they got rid of that political element. But yeah, so the original comic strip I find is fascinating as an example of right-wing populism.
And
I don't like the movie so much, because they all try to avoid, you know, the harsh political vision at the heart of this.
Yeah, and that's what we've learned in recent weeks, isn't it? That comics can be quite serious in what they depict.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, and I think that's it's unexpected to me, because I do sort of research on comics, and I've always thought of them as important. And it was kind of, but even I wasn't quite prepared for, like, you know, what a fault line they can be on world on the world stage. And so it is, it's interesting when something you study turns out to be more important than you thought. Although I think that's happened a lot to me, and it's a very curious thing, because, you know, when I was in university, I took courses with students of Leo Strauss, and I thought a lot about, like, Leo Strauss and his philosophy, mm-hmm. and it seemed like just a kind of eccentric hobby on my part, and I never thought it would have, like, any real-world impact, but then you suddenly had, like, you know, George W. Bush and his advisors, Paul Wolfowitz, you know, who came out of the Straussian school, and he had all these Straussians in the Pentagon, and so suddenly something that, you know, like, was just an academic interest of mine turned out to have, like, a real-world implications, and it's happened a couple of times with me where, and with comics, I mean, like, you know, there's stuff I was reading when I was young, like, you know, Frank Miller's Daredevil or the X-Men, and I always thought, like, when I was reading them, I thought, like, you know, like, oh, this is interesting, but, you know, like, it's a kind of personal, quirky thing that I'm interested in, and I never expected them to, you know, but now all that stuff, like, dominates, like, Hollywood.
Yeah. Are you working on, say a big cover story or a piece that we might see shortly?
Yeah, I'm working on not a cover story, but it's working on this thing about Giuliani's very odd comments about Obama being an anti-colonialist, mm-hmm. and looking at, like, how anti-colonial became, like, a term of abuse, which is very odd when you think of the United States, and you know, not just its, like, origins in the American Revolution against the British Empire, but, you know, like, more throughout the 20th century, American presidents like Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower have opposed European colonialism, right? I mean, largely because they wanted to open up the Third World to American markets, but still, it's very odd that to hear Americans suddenly, you know, saying that it's terrible to oppose the British Empire.
Will we ever see in the Walrus again?
If they want me, yeah, sure. I think I'm kind of busy with other projects, but yeah, I think at some point, if they ask me to write something or if I have an idea that seems like a good Walrus idea, I'll pitch something to them. Yeah.
Jeet, this has been great fun for me because you're a figure in the conversation that I've been fascinated by and have enjoyed a great deal. So thanks for this and congratulations on this book. It's a great collection. It's also a handsome looking book as well.
Oh yeah, that's one reason I went with Porcupine's Quill. They do beautiful books. They've done the paper stock, and I should mention the cover is done. Not just the cover, the whole book design is by Seth, the Canadian cartoonist, mm-hmm. and he's done, like, a really lovely job. Like, so just, like, even if you think my words are garbage, it's actually a book you would want to own for the physically.
Thanks for this, Jeet.
Thank you.
The website for more is at jeethere.com. The book is called Sweet Lechery, Reviews, Essays, and Profiles. It's from the Porcupine's Quill. Its author, Jeet Here, joined me on the line from Regina in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.